From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, co-founder of Yes Magazine, Sarah Van Gelder, talks about her latest book, The Revolution Where You Live. Social justice advocate Kari Lazar-White discusses his debut novel, Passage. And Oscar-nominated actress Jennifer Jason Leigh reflects on what it was like to play Lady Bird Johnson in the film LBJ. But first, while the White House attempts to solve the North Korea nuclear crisis, President Trump's rhetoric toward Iran is becoming increasingly hostile. He has antagonized Iran's leaders by decertifying the 2015 multinational nuclear agreement, and he recently accused Iran of firing a ballistic missile at Saudi Arabia, a claim Iranian military leaders deny. Trita Parsi is the president of the National Iranian American Council. His latest book is called Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
This horrific news out of Texas, this church shooting. It's fascinating that you happen to be our guest, in part because every time we have a conversation, it's always about the Muslim ban. It's always about terrorism. International terrorism, terrorism from without. And here again, another conversation we have to have about domestic terrorism. What do you make of what happened in Texas?
I'm just heartbroken as everyone else.
Yeah.
I grew up in Europe, so I have to tell you, I have a little bit hard time understanding why it is that we believe that the right to bear arms is above the right for children to live.
And yet this conversation about the Second Amendment is as difficult, impossible a conversation to have as is the conversation about the U.S. and Asia.
Yeah, and there is so much that appears to be done in order to defend against terrorism, and there is an expectation that we can get that down to zero.
Right.
I think that's a nice goal, but we're doing a lot of different things that actually doesn't do anything to help. That the Muslim ban is an example of really not targeting any of these things. Take a look at what happened in New York. The gentleman in New York who did that horrific crime in New York was from Uzbekistan. That country is not on the list. It would not have been affected, and clearly wasn't affected.
Right.
Moreover, that person was like almost every other domestic terrorist that has done things in connection with ISIS. He was radicalized in the United States. He was not radical and then came here and then committed a crime. He was radicalized while he was here. So we're going overboard at times and doing things that actually are counterproductive on that. But then when it comes to the domestic terror that is happening with greater frequency, we're not doing much at all.
Yep. Do you think that these conversations about Iran and Iraq and North Korea and the travel ban and the countries on the list, do you think that conversation is overshadowing or somehow preventing us from having the kind of conversation about domestic terror that we ought to be having?
I think absolutely, because what happens is that media decides to focus on this issue, making people think that that is a very, very significant threat. Mm-hmm. In fact, making them believe that it's a far greater threat than it is. It is a threat, but it has to be seen in proportion. Whereas we're not doing that with some of the domestic issues. We immediately explain that away by saying, well, that's because of a mental disorder, or this was a lone wolf thing, etc. And we're in a way kind of downplaying what actually oftentimes appears to be a greater risk than what is happening coming in from the outside. This is not an argument that we should neglect any of these, but there's a disproportionate attention given to one and far less given to the other. And this ultimately is a problem. It's the same thing when it comes to the Muslim ban. The reason why it's counterproductive is because it's focusing on the wrong thing. And as a result, it's taking our eye away from the real issues that we should be focusing on that could be effective in preventing these type of terrorist attacks.
Yeah. Let me go across the water now, way across the water, across the pond, to the president's trip to Asia. Do you have high expectations, low expectations, or no expectations at all from this trip?
I have very low expectations. I think what we have seen so far is that this is a White House that, at the top of it, at the helm, does not understand international relations, does not understand the complexity, does not understand what actually diplomacy means, and as a result, is not capable of playing that leadership role that the United States not only has played, but many allies in that region. I mean, South Korea, Japan, all of them are very eagerly, they're seeking American leadership here, because clearly they don't have the capacity to be able to handle a North Korea with nuclear weapons on their own. But at the same time, they're terribly worried, because the language that Trump is using is only ratcheting things up. his threats, his way of using Twitter to be able to conduct this, has caused a tremendous amount of anxiety because they're terrified. They're the ones who are going to be all dead if there's a nuclear disaster taking place right now. So they want a measured approach. They want some wisdom in all of this, and that is profoundly lacking right now.
Mm-hmm. So Putin was in Iran, and it seems to me that the way that the president is playing the Iran nuclear treaty issue has left an opening for Putin in Russia.
It has left an opening for almost everyone. Yeah. Here we had a deal. I would call it a triumph of diplomacy. It was tremendously difficult to get. There was a very big risk because almost no one believed, except for some people in the White House and some supporting organizations, that there was a diplomatic path here. And we managed to essentially prevent what was very clearly, we managed to resolve what was clearly an international crisis on the verge of a military confrontation. Mm-hmm. To resolve that peacefully through diplomacy, without a single shot being fired, without a single angry infantile 4 a.m. tweet being sent off. Mm-hmm. And now we're taking that and we're turning that triumph into a disaster by the president decertifying this deal, which then is causing all of these other countries that were part of the deal, this was not just between the U.S. and Iran, Russia was there, France, Germany, England, China, they're all now joining essentially with the Iranians. And the United States is being isolated. So Putin's response to Trump decertifying the deal was that he flew to Tehran and he signed $30 billion of investment contracts. Mm-hmm. The French, who otherwise have been very tough on Iran and remain tough on Iran, denounced, I think a day or two after Trump decertified the Iran deal, that Macron is going to be making a visit to Iran next spring. Mm-hmm. This will be the first visit by a French president to Iran since 1976. This is all coming as a result of them trying to protect the deal, buffer the deal by moving closer to Iran.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of the fact that the president did decertify it, but he didn't completely implode it, but he kicks it over to Congress basically to do something about it. What do you expect to happen there, if anything?
So it's interesting that you mentioned that because a lot of people expect that he was going to implode it right away. Mm-hmm. He is imploding it. He's just doing it in two steps rather than in one step. Mm-hmm. He's kicking it off to Congress, I think with the hope to make sure that he can share the blame for the ensuing disaster with Congress or perhaps even blame the whole thing on Congress. What he's done right now, and this is very important for the public to understand, and he's gone to Congress and he's working with Congressman, with Senator Cotton, to what they call fixing the deal. But in reality is that they're trying to unilaterally change the terms of this multilateral agreement. No one single country can just on its own change the terms of an agreement that seven countries negotiated over the course of several years. Imagine if the Iranians, if their parliament passed a law and said, well, all of the commitments Iran has, we're not going to honor them until the United States leaves Iraq, until the United States stops selling arms to Saudi Arabia. That would be a clear violation of the deal. And that is exactly what is being prepared in the Senate right now to essentially change the terms of the deal, which is a violation. This will cause the deal to collapse, even though it's not that type of an immediate effort to collapse the deal. And that's tremendously dangerous. No other country in the Security Council or the countries that are party to the deal are in agreement with this.
How do you read what the president has said of late about North Korea?
Again, I think there's a problem here, which is that I think Trump believes that he can bluff his way to a solution here. And that's just simply not the way this thing works. Mm-hmm. There's a certain parallel to what was going on with Iran, in which I believe the United States adopted unrealistic positions early on and then had to essentially walk them back. And that is a problem because they ended up in some ways actually costing the U.S. a better solution precisely because they had taken such exaggerated positions. In the case of Iran, it was a zero enrichment objective. In the case of North Korea, the insistence that they're never going to be able to have nuclear weapons despite the fact that they do and that regime change will remain on the table. As long as we stick to those positions, we're not going to see this solution, any solution to what's going on in North Korea right now. And if on top of that, the president kills the Iran deal or continues this path of imploding it, why would North Korea or any other country for that matter strike a deal or a compromise with the United States when the U.S. has proven itself not to be trustworthy? The Iran deal was only struck 2 years ago. It's been working. 8 times now, the International Atomic Energy Agency has confirmed the Iranians are living up to their end of the bargain. Still, Trump is imploding it. With that track record, why would send anyone else, particularly the North Koreans, go along with diplomacy?
Is the president going to be successful in getting China where he wants them to be on the North Korea question?
Not if he's doing what he's doing on Iran.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, that credibility that is needed in order to be able to get the North Koreans to move, the Chinese to mm-hmm. move, is simply not there right now. So I think if you take a look at what Obama did when he decided that he's really going to try to pursue diplomacy with Iran, he first recognized that in order to have successful diplomacy, I have to help create an atmosphere that is conducive to diplomacy. That meant a much different language when he was talking about Iran. There was no more emphasis that all options are on the table. He took away terms that didn't translate well to Persian, such as, you know, carrots and sticks, because he wanted to signal, I am actually serious about diplomacy. I want to make this work. We're seeing the exact opposite. Every time Donald Trump is tweeting about this, we're doing the exact opposite. We're moving further and further and further away from any chance for real diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Finally, is it possible to get back to losing Iran as an enemy, or is the damage already done by Mr. Trump irreparable?
I think it's possible, but yeah. We're running out of time. We need to make sure that this deal does not collapse, and that means that Congress, if it chooses to vote for new sanctions or measures that would change the terms of the deal, in my view, that's the equivalent of Congress giving George Bush authority to use military force in Iraq in 2002. It is a vote that will take us to war. If that happens, I think, unfortunately, we'll have Iran as an enemy for quite some time.
Trita Parsi's new book is called Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita, good to have you on the program. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Our nation has a long list of social challenges, including gun violence, racism, climate change, to name just three. But according to writer Sarah Van Gelder, communities across the nation are creating ways to combat these problems and are remaking America from the ground up. She's written about these communities in a new book called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America. Sarah is also the co-founder of Yes Magazine, which focuses on reframing the biggest problems of our times through their solutions. Sarah, good to have you on this program.
I am so honored to be here. I've been a fan for years.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Thank you. Honored to have you here. The timing of your presence couldn't be more propitious given what just happened in Texas. I think I want to start our conversation there, because if ever there were a moment, or is a moment, where we feel utterly helpless, right, it's when someone walks into a house of worship and kills 25 plus people. Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk about the revolution where you live, but what do you have to say about how we navigate ourselves through these, another one of these moments?
You know, it's a really tough one, and this is a time when people come together where they live, they come together for support, they love on each other, and that's the only way we can get through these kinds of personal tragedies. Yeah. But the other thing is, you know, there's all this talk about how we can't get good gun control legislation because our country's too divided.
Yeah.
But the truth is, on some really important matters, we're actually not that far apart. For example, 86% of Americans believe we should have a prohibition on purchasing guns if you've been convicted of a violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
This individual had been convicted of domestic abuse. And actually, so many of these mass killers, turns out that they have been part of some really horrific domestic level violence before they actually go out and do mass killings.
Why do you think it is, though, Sarah, that even on the things, to your point, that we agree on, we can't seem to get traction?
Well, I think there are people who actually benefit from keeping us divided.
Yeah,
I think the NRA raises lots of money, and certain candidates, maybe on both sides of the political spectrum, but certainly on the Republican side, just raise a lot of money with a lot of fear-mongering. They're telling people that somebody's going to come after your guns, and you're not going to like it. And, you know, the truth is that there's a lot of common sense in the middle.
Yeah.
It's not that many Americans want nobody to have a gun. Very few people would say that. Not so many people that says that we should have any kind of arms in the world, that we should have missiles to take down airplanes. I don't think anybody would argue you should have that.
Yeah.
So someplace in the middle, there's actually a lot of common ground, but you don't make so much in campaign contributions if you're...
Yeah. I'm not naive about this, but I think part of what troubles me every time we have this conversation after another horrific shooting is the point you've just made, that the numbers are abundantly clear, that the overwhelming number of Americans want to see something done right. about guns in America. Mm-hmm. And yet, because of gerrymandering, because of the NRA, because of safe seats, and the list goes on and on and on, it just seems to me that even in a democracy where the demos is supposed to rule, where the will of the people is supposed to be the final say, on this issue of guns, the numbers are clear, but the will of the people gets thwarted right. every time.
Well, on a lot of issues, there's a recent study that shows that we, the people, actually have very little influence on yeah. what's happening nationally. The people who have the influence are the people who have the money, the big, big business, big corporations, and the associations that represent them. But at the local level, it's different. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I've been focusing on local for so long.
Tell me what you learned, what you sensed about the discontent of the American people as you took this 12,000-mile journey.
Right. So this was 2015. It was mm-hmm. before the election was really ramping up. But I just went through one state after another, especially in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, in Appalachia, in the South, just one place after another where I just felt like people were feeling really left out. There was way more poverty than I expected. I certainly mm-hmm. expected to see some, and I appreciate the tour, the poverty tour that you went on and reported on. Mm-hmm. I certainly expected to see some of that, but I just didn't know how deep and how wide it was and how deeply discouraged so many people were.
So you were sensing and feeling the discontent, but did you have any idea that it would play out the way that it did just a year or so later?
You know, I didn't. And part of the reason was I kept looking at the opinion polls, and opinion polls kept showing things were going to go the other way. But on the other hand, I could see that people weren't going to go along with the status quo, too.
Right.
I think a lot of people would have gone along with Bernie Sanders. He was also an outsider mm-hmm. candidate. I think he was inspiring people to say, I can make some real change. And I think, on the other hand, Donald Trump was saying, I'm going to make real change. And maybe that was more like throwing a bomb in the middle of our country. But mm-hmm. people were desperate enough that they were saying, OK, I want to see where things land.
You think revolution is still possible at the local level?
I don't really think it's possible. I think it's inevitable.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think people are not going to keep putting up with this. Things are changing. The economy simply isn't working for too many people. And I think the other thing that's changing that we don't talk about as much is the climate.
Yeah.
You know, people can see the beginnings of it. Certainly places like Houston and Puerto Rico, things have already changed in a big way. They're not going back to what they were before.
Yeah.
And I think we're just going to be seeing more of that, too.
What is it about the local level that makes the terrain so fertile mm-hmm. for change?
Well, I think, for one thing, it's a place we actually have power. Mm-hmm. We can still get together. We can still show up at our city council or at our member of Congress's office or at the state legislature, and we can still have an impact. So that's one thing. I think another thing is that we have so many divides in our country, and so much of that is because of what we're seeing on television or what we're seeing in social media. But when we actually sit across from each other face to face and see that these other people who we don't know very well are actually interesting, complex people, mm-hmm. they're not these kind of caricatures that we see so often on the media, I think it makes it much harder to other people to treat them as less than. And I think we're kind of brought into a struggle to figure out, how do we work together? How do we get along together? Because we're going to have to be together. We're going to be neighbors for the long term.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to talk to or address any of these issues that seem so intractable, like homelessness, for example?
I didn't talk directly with folks about homelessness. But the three things that I was really looking at, mm-hmm. one of them was income inequality.
Right.
And how do we reinvent the economy so mm-hmm. that people can have an ownership stake in the economy? Mm-hmm. A second was the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And the third was racism.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the three things that I was looking at, because I think all three of them are sort of existential issues for our country.
Sure.
They're kind of make or break.
Yeah.
And I was really curious, since they were so stuck on the national level, if in each of those cases, if I could find really good solutions locally. And in each case, I was really encouraged by what I found.
Yeah. I raise that issue of homelessness because it seems to me that one of the things that we don't recognize, perhaps, is that poverty and income inequality have so many tentacles
yes.
that offshoot it. And we tend to talk about it in a vacuum without recognizing that there's so many layers and textures to what that actually looks like. Mm-hmm. And I wonder sometimes whether or not most Americans have a real sense of what poverty actually looks like in 2017.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, in Seattle, where I live, there's this boomy economy, and there's huge numbers of people on the streets.
You can't
walk through downtown without running into tent campments and people under bridges. And there's a relationship between that, because the price of housing is going up as there are more people competing for those homes. So yeah, I think that, you know, the best solution I've seen to that is land trusts. Mm-hmm. Take some of the housing out of the speculative market, just make it a nonprofit. The land trust that in Burlington, Vermont, the people who live in those were the folks that didn't lose their homes during the housing crisis. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the solutions I think is really promising. And another one is, I think it's the state of Utah that's been saying to homeless people, we're not going to wait for you to become sober, for you to get everything. We're just going to find you a home. Mm-hmm. And then if you're interested in working to deal with some of these underlying issues, or the PTSD from being in violent wartime situation, when you're ready, or if you're ready, we'll work with you on that. But meanwhile, you need to have a roof over your head.
Speaking of intractable issues, racism. I don't want to color the question too much, but tell me how you dug into that.
Well, the question I was asking when I went to different communities is, what have you figured out to do? Mm-hmm. What's your answer? And those vary tremendously by communities. Mm-hmm. So if a New York, small college town, predominantly white, but they have an African-American population. Mm-hmm. So there's a theater ensemble that takes stories from the community that are difficult stories, that are challenging stories about race. They do theatrical productions about them, and then open up a conversation. What does this mean about who we are? We think we're really liberal, but here's a kid that the police were called on for no apparent reason, except that he was in a white neighborhood and he was African American. Mm-hmm. And I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is of course famous for the 1960 sit-ins.
Sure, sure.
And maybe not so famous, but more immediately for a lot of people there, there was a shooting in 1979. A bunch of Klan members and Nazis shot on a protest, a workers' rights protest, killed 5 people. It was one of those issues where nobody was convicted. All white juries acquitted everybody. And it just sat there festering in the community for years until some local activists said, we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to raise up what really happened here. Mm-hmm. City Council said, no, they weren't interested. They object. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. They didn't even want it to happen. But the local community did anyway. They brought in some people from outside, some local leaders. They brought people in to testify who were willing to testify. They didn't have any subpoena power. And they wrote a report. And they said, this is what really happened. This was not a shootout. Mm-hmm. One side came armed, the other side didn't. The police had an informant. They knew what was going to happen. They chose to hang back. They put it all out there. And then when I was there, it was still a question. It's like, well, that report happened, but it didn't make any difference. And some people were still puzzling about that. But just last August, the Greensboro City Council apologized officially to the victims and their families and cited that Truth and Reconciliation Commission report to say, we see what happened here and we're sorry.
I'm glad you said that. I've often wondered whether or not we could benefit as a society, certainly in local communities, benefit more, Sarah, from engaging that TRC model. Everybody knows how well it worked in South Africa. Here you have all these years of apartheid. And rather than go on a witch hunt to find every criminal who had misbehaved and had maimed or tortured or killed during apartheid, they set up a TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and it worked wonders for the democracy, in the establishment of democracy in South Africa. Your example now in Greensboro of how well it worked. We talk a lot about civilian review boards when police misbehave across the country, but I wonder whether or not you think that TRC model might be more effective if more communities tried that like they did in Greensboro.
You know, I think so. I don't think it's a panacea.
It doesn't
take care of things by itself.
Sure.
And so many of the things I saw were incremental steps.
Right.
And at first it's hard to say, you know, how much difference did it make? But you can see the difference when people can no longer make stuff up. You can't create this false equivalency, for one thing. And you create then the foundation for the apology.
The magazine is called Yes, now celebrating 20 years. And the new text is called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through a New America by Sarah Van Gelder. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Kari Lazar White is best known for his work as a social justice advocate. He co-founded the Brotherhood Sister Soul, a nationally renowned youth development and educational organization. He's also an attorney and a writer. His debut novel is called Passage. It's set in New York and centers around a young man called Warrior and his struggle to navigate and confront the forces that surround him. Kari, good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Tess.
I was fascinated, pleased, but fascinated by the fact that you called this kid Warrior. Tell me why.
You know, I think it's so important when you're telling the stories of young black men, when they're telling their own stories, that they're able to put their own narrative front and center. This is a novel that's about the internal psyche of a young man. And what he loves about the meaning of his name is that it tells every single person he comes in contact with who he is and what he represents. And he feels he's at struggle for his very survival, to survive the conditions he's facing. Even though he's from a family of great love, his mother and his father provide so much support, but still the moment he leaves the doors, he's faced with the socioeconomic conditions that so many young people face, and he feels like he has to be a warrior to navigate that. And it's the tension between being strong and tough and wearing the mask, but also being sensitive and loving towards his family, and that runs through the novel.
You chose to give him a mother and a father. Why?
I think it's absolutely critical that we tell more stories about the wholeness and the power and the beauty of the black family. Obviously, it is a truth that so many of our young people grow up without a father in their life, but so many grow up with a father in their life. And so his parents are separated, but they have deep love for their son. And his father lives in Brooklyn and his mother lives in Harlem. And I wanted to show that deep love between a black man and his son. That's intimate, that's affectionate, that's loving, that's supportive. I think it's a story that needs to be told more often. And if we look at our history in this country, the reason that children have been able to survive over so many years of slavery and segregation and the continuing issues is because at times of the strength of the black family. And so often instead it's painted in a negative light. Mm-hmm. And that conversation needs to be had, but we also have to have a conversation about the strength of the family.
We all have our critics. So for those who would say that the drama that Warrior endures is a stereotypical story of what black boys in America deal with. So for those who would say it's on the one hand stereotypical, how do you respond to those? And the folk on the other hand who would say mother and father both in the house, that's aspirational. How do you respond to those critics?
Well, for those who say that it's stereotypical, I would say they don't live in those communities and it's not their reality. The truth is that when we talk about violence in urban areas, whether it's Los Angeles or Houston or New York, or whether we talk about it in rural areas as well, it's not just about the violent act. It's about growing up around the ambient feeling of violence, the feeling that violence is right around the corner, that it can happen at any moment. And that's what I portray in the novel. This is not a novel that's filled with violent acts. It's the fear of violence. Mm-hmm. What does that do to the psyche of a young man? How traumatic is that for so many of our children that we allow them to grow up in those conditions? So I don't think it's stereotypical at all. He's based in great love and great support, who he is as a black young man in terms of his history and his culture and his people, but he's also confronted with the very, very real specter of violence. And again, I think the fact that he has a mother and father in his home, they're separated. His father lives in Brooklyn, his mother in Harlem. But the fact that children grow up with powerful male influences in their life and powerful female is certainly true. That is the other side of the coin. As rampant as a lack of fathers are in our community, we also know that there are millions of black men doing what they're supposed to do in our community as well.
How do you respond to that critique? I know I hear it all the time. I know you hear it all the time in the work that you do, which is this notion that oftentimes comes from the right, that the problem of black America is a problem of parenting, and that if we had more men in the families, in the homes, we wouldn't have half the problems that we deal with. How do you respond to the folk who say that that is primarily our problem, that we lack black men in homes?
Well, that's a big question. Yeah. I think there are a few different answers to it. I mean, the first is that we have a problem with manhood in our country. We have a problem with masculinity in our country. The majority of violence in this country is committed by white men, both murder and rape. And while black men are disproportionately represented in a lot of these statistics, violence is still perpetrated by men of all colors. We have all these mass shootings, and people often talk about that's about either mental health or that's about guns. One thing that's not talked about is masculinity and manhood. The women who are mentally ill are not doing mass shootings. It's men who are doing it. So do I think that there is a crisis of manhood in this country? Yes. Is that reflected in the black community? Absolutely. And do we need to talk about it? Without question. But the idea that that is the root of the problem in a country where 13 generations were born into slavery, 4 generations were born into segregation, and we have 2 generations born legally free, when we still have the kind of systemic oppression and racism that we know exists in this country, and to say the reason for the difficulties in terms of socioeconomic conditions for our children is because of black men, is taking the responsibility from where it should be put and putting it on the victim of the reality.
Yeah. Right. So the work that you do every day is real work.
Definitely.
In the real world.
Definitely.
The conditions that Warrior has to navigate in this novel are real conditions that real Negroes have to deal with every day. Mm-hmm. And yet you chose to tell this story through a novel. Why a novel?
You know, Taz, I think art at its best, you know, inspires people. It's a journey that allows people into another person's experience. That I can read a novel that's about a white boy in a rural community, mm-hmm. and it's J.D. Salinger's story of Holden Caulfield, and that stays with me. I can read Maxine Hong Kingston's beautiful novel of a Chinese American girl coming of age, and that inspires me. So I think part of the power of art is to allow others into the story and for them to understand things that sometimes statistics and policy mm-hmm. and law doesn't allow people to be able to do, even though I often talk in that language as well.
Yeah.
But then this is also a novel that's written for young people facing these conditions. This is not a young adult novel. I hope people of all ages read it. But what I want is for especially young men in their teens and in their 20s to see their story here. And I think that there's a way to reach people by showing their story in this novel. I have a good friend, young man in his 30s. He said to me it was the first time he saw his face on the cover of a book.
Yeah.
Just the optics of this is my story, how powerful that is. And I think the last piece is that when you start talking about the power of art to transform, it's an idea. It's storytelling. Mm-hmm. And there's a way to tell a story in a novel that is not really possible when you're writing a political essay.
I'll come back to these black boys in just a second. Let me start with the good white folk first. Tell me why it is that you think that they will read a book and get a reality from a fiction text when many of them don't seem to get it when it's in their face, live and in living color on the network news every night.
I think that, you know, this is a country that only exists because of the objectification, the enslavement, and the continual persecution of black and brown bodies. That's what the country is built on, and we know that, and we know mm-hmm. that so well. That's only been allowed to happen because of white folks who have been aggressively against black and brown people allowing it to continue, and also theoretically white people of good faith who have not stood up enough. And so we live in a time right now where this country has elected a person who articulates anti-woman litigation, issues, mm-hmm. who talks about black and brown people and Muslim people in the most horrific way. None of that was enough, right? None of that was enough to stand in his face. Mm-hmm. That wasn't just those who were the known to be racist. Those were people's neighbors. Those were people's friends, right? So this isn't going to speak to all of the, quote, good white folks who aren't getting it on the news and also won't get it through this novel. What I do think is it will speak to those who are our allies, the people who truly want a more humane world, who reject the kind of country we're living in now, this inhumane institution that we are living under. And I think it will speak to them. I hope it will.
Yeah. What I'm about to say now, you know well, given mm-hmm. the work that you do, Kari. But I've been honored and I think blessed to do a number of primetime documentaries for PBS over the years about the plight and condition, the suffering, quite frankly, of young black boys. Mm-hmm. One of the things I learned many years ago, that again, you know full well, is if black boys don't develop a love of reading by the third grade, mm-hmm. they're doomed. Mm-hmm. And so many of them, I discovered in the research, don't develop a love of reading by the third grade because they don't see themselves in the narrative. They mm-hmm. don't see themselves as mm-hmm. characters. That's the point you raised a moment ago about these young black boys who've never seen themselves on the cover of a book. I wonder whether or not you think that some of the issues that you have to navigate every day through the work you do with black boys would not exist if black boys, in fact, developed a love of reading earlier on.
You know, I think that the educational realities and outcomes that our children face is certainly a part of the crisis that we're facing. Mm-hmm. This idea that somehow doing well in school is being white is a very new phenomenon, as we know well. There was mm-hmm. nothing blacker than doing well in school.
Right.
Our universities were birthed out of this. Teachers could move throughout the South and have homes to stay in because they were revered. And so I think part of it is not about having to find a new answer, but trying to find some of the solutions that were already there. The emphasis in our community on education, the desire to ensure that all of our children get the right education. That's done in two different ways. It's done by the direct service kind of work that I do at Brotherhood Sister Soul, mm-hmm. that we do in our schools, helping the small number of young people to love learning, to love to read, to see in themselves aspirational goals of who they can become as men and as women. But it's also about changing the policies that create those conditions. I mean, the situation of education that we have across this country is abhorrent, that we allow children to attend schools where even if they do what they're supposed to be doing, theoretically, they're graduating with an eighth grade level education in urban systems all across the country, means we're selling those kids a false bill of goods. It means we're telling even the children who pushed through, you will not be allowed to compete in our society. And so I think education's key, but so's math and science and coding and all aspects of development of young people. I also think the arts are very important. I think ensuring that young people have a space to tell their story, to be able to deal with the trauma and the pain that they face in their life, often arts is an outlet for that, and that we see the arts ripped out of so many of our schools across the country means that that opportunity is not there. So I think we have to return to a much more holistic approach to the education of our young people, which so many of our schools don't focus on, even the ones that theoretically get the good test scores, that theoretically provide an education to prepare children. Are we preparing them to be ethical and moral people in an inhumane world and to try to change that world, or are we just preparing them for a test? And so we have to really look at the holistic development of young people, which is what I think is key. And that goes back to the earlier part of our conversation about what kind of citizens are we creating, right? This isn't a black and brown issue. If we're not dealing with moral issues of humanity, then we are not ensuring that we have more good white folks, more progressive white folks who will work with us hand in hand to change issues, more progressive Asian folks and Latino folks and black folks. This is a national issue we're dealing with. It's why we elected a president like Trump. It's why we have so many mass shootings all around the country. This divorcing from a more ethical and moral way to live our lives. And I don't think we're teaching that in schools because people are afraid to teach those issues. They're afraid to confront what undergirds that, you know?
I appreciate your work and your witness, and I thank you for the text. It's a novel. It's called Passage by Kari Lazar White. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Jennifer Jason Leigh has had a long and successful career in Hollywood. Her projects include Twin Peaks and movies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High and The Hateful Eight. Her performance in that film earned her an Oscar nomination. She now plays First Lady Lady Bird Johnson in Rob Reiner's LBJ. Before our conversation, hear now a clip of Jennifer and actor Woody Harrelson playing LBJ in the film.
Minnie, your mother didn't turn her back on you because she didn't love you. She just couldn't stand to see you when you weren't at your best.
She wouldn't want you, me now.
You're gonna be all right. You're a good man in a tight spot. President Kennedy did wonderful things for America, not the least of which was choosing you to be his successor. He was a man of great ideas. Now the country needs a man who can deliver.
First of all, you nailed that accent, for starters. Secondly, I love that scene because it's rare that we see LBJ in such tender moments.
And he's so afraid and vulnerable. Yeah. And I think that's something that Rob really wanted to show, and Lady Bird was his opportunity to show that side of him.
Yeah, yeah. Because we've seen her or actress play her on screen so many times, how did you approach your particular turn?
I read everything that I could read. I of course looked at every video I could find and all of the photographs, the way she held herself. And the thing I found the most helpful was that there's recordings of theirs, like their phone conversations. And they're so intimate. And you really get a sense of the marriage and how much he leaned on her and what a force she was in a very kind way, in a very loving way. She was his strongest critic. And they were really a team, you know, that that marriage, and she was instrumental in his presidency and in his entire political career. So there's something very intimate in those recordings, and so I would just play them almost on a loop to really, because I find sometimes the voice is a great way in to a character.
Yeah, we know that she was in part his spine. To paraphrase what you said earlier, tell me more. Unpack for me when you said that she was his greatest critic. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a really funny recording. Mm-hmm. I mean, funny, very sweet recording where he doesn't. She calls him after, I think it was maybe his second press conference. It was a very early one. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, basically critiques it. Mm-hmm. And she says where he seemed stiff and he took too long, saying his message, that he didn't make enough eye contact with the people. And then she gives him praise and the things that he did really well. But she's not, what's the word when you use, she's not soft-pedaling it
in any
way. I mean, she's really, she's being very direct with him and straightforward, and he really takes it in.
Yeah.
So there's a real, there's something about how much he leaned on her and trusted her and took her advice. And then there are times, there are other conversations that you can hear online where there was this big scandal involving Jenkins, who was a very, very close friend of theirs. And she wanted to make a public statement saying that they support him and they got behind him. And he was on the tarmac about to get on a plane, and she did not care. She wanted to make the statement. He was like, no, 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 you can't, you can't, you can't. And she, you know, 2 hours later, she made the statement.
Made it anyway.
Yeah.
I've talked to so many people over the years who've had a chance, obviously, to play historic figures. What's the joy in doing that for you, and what was the challenge in doing that for you?
I think they're sort of the same
thing.
Yeah. I mean, the joy is that it's an incredible challenge.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel this huge weight and this huge responsibility approaching it, because it is a real person.
Yeah.
And you want to do that person justice and be as honest as you can and really capture them. And because they actually exist, there's a lot of material to help you find your way there, but it's also very difficult because people can look at the real person and can look at you and see where it feels right and where it doesn't feel right.
Yeah. Tell me about working with Woody.
Oh, he's incredible to work with.
Yeah.
First of all, I've been such a huge fan for so long. And you know, when you first meet someone that you have admired for a very long time, or you first start working with someone you've admired, but you've never had that actual working relationship, you don't know what to expect. And he's so welcoming doesn't even come close. I mean, he really is so inclusive of everyone he works for. And Laura, his wife, is like cooking for everyone, and they're inviting you over, and suddenly you're getting on a bike after 13 years of having never been on a bike, and you're riding through a park with him. And he's an incredible magician.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like, if you can ever get Woody Harrelson to do a card trick for you, it will blow your mind. So I just, we would text each other in their voices and, you know, using their phrases for one another. And they're an incredible couple. They're an incredible couple, Woody and Laura. And they really brought me into their family. Yeah. And it was really nice because I was there on my own. And it was lovely to sort of be a part of that.
Speaking of texting each other in voices, are you one of those actors when you hit the set, you don't come out of character? You stay.
It depends. It depends on the role, and it depends on how tricky the accent is.
Yeah. But what about this one?
I stayed in this accent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this accent was very tricky, so it was just easier for me to just talk to it all the time and listen to it all the time.
Yeah.
Now, what's so great is Apple has, you know, the ear pods.
Right.
So they didn't have them when we were actually shooting this, but on this last thing I did, the Patrick Melrose novels, I could actually listen to the pop music of the 60s or whatever I was needed to listen to that could actually help me inform the scene, and it's completely hidden.
Yeah.
by your hair. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't do it all the time, but there are times you can do that, and that's kind of great, especially if you have an accent, to be able to actually hear it, or the music of the period, or whatever it is that's helping influence you. Or...
Was there something particular about that period that you liked, wish you could have experienced at the level that they experienced it? I mean, there are these periods of time that if I could go back in time, I'd like to go back and check certain.
Which ones? When would you like to go?
I mean, I was born in the mid 60s, but I was such a baby that I feel like sometimes I just feel like I missed out on so much by not being of age in the 60s, just to see so much of what happened then.
Oh, so much change.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
You okay where you are?
I'm okay.
You don't want to go. No, Back to the Future for you.
I don't think so. Yeah. Like, I used to think when I was younger, I was in love with Fitzgerald.
Right.
So I always wanted to live in that period.
Right.
But now, not so much. I think I'm also, you just realize as you get older how much change happens within your own lifetime.
Right.
And it's hard to imagine going back to the rotary phone.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of work.
But the one. Two.
Yeah.
Yeah, but these are crazy times that we're living in.
Oh, it's insane.
I'm not sure I want to be here in this madness.
No, I'm not sure I want to.
Maybe I do want to go back to the 60s for a few years or something.
Or at least go back 2 years ago.
Yeah, a couple years, 2 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
I take your point. That went over my head, but I got that. As an artist, how are you navigating these crazy times?
Yeah, I feel like we're in really crazy time right now, like a time we've never had before. I mean, you look at how much Lyndon Johnson got accomplished, and all of the great. A lot of us, you know, associate him with the Vietnam War, but and that's the lovely thing about this film is how many great, incredible bills he passed.
Voting rights, civil rights, Medicaid.
Yeah.
PBS, NPR, I mean, all that.
Head Start. I mean, it's like goes on and on and on and on. Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, all of that stuff. And then you look at what's happening today.
Nothing.
And so many things being tried, you know, are being, he's trying to strip away.
Sure.
And all the things Obama put in place, he's trying to strip away. So I think it's a very frightening time that we're living in. And I'm completely addicted to the news. I'm not. You know, I'm a very sort of private person, but I have very strong political belief. It doesn't mean that I like speak out about it all the time, but I do think this is a frightening time.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it the way you said it, but it is a fascinating parallel when you go see the movie LBJ to consider how much they did get done in those very difficult times and how little, I mean, almost nothing.
Congress
gets, they don't pass anything these days.
No.
It's like a...
And he was able to reach across the aisle.
Because he came from the Senate, so he understood how it worked.
Yeah.
He'd been there.
He also understood politics.
Yeah.
And
that helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, it helps to know what the job is.
Yeah. I'll leave that right where it is. The movie is LBJ with Woody Harrelson and Jennifer Jason Leigh. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsiabwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.